my grandfather's encounter with the devil, which you met in 1945 near Anahuac, Nuevo León, Mexico, about an hour southwest of Laredo. My grandpa was 16, playing poker with his cousin at a small bar out in the country, when a handsome, well-dressed stranger strolled into the room. He was tall and thin, sporting a crisp white shirt, black pants, and matching black boots. Immediately, for reasons my grandpa never fully understood, he suspected that this man was Satan. He kept a cool head as the man approached and asked if he could play a hand. Cards were dealt, bets were made. The tension grew as it became clear that the two were closely matched. When each revealed his hand, the stranger had won. Something felt off. My grandpa suspected that the man had cheated, and as their eyes met, the stranger's smirk twisted into a terrible grimace. Two horns began sprouting from his forehead, and as grandpa looked down at the stranger's feet, he saw a chicken foot and a goat hoof in the place of the boots. Suddenly, the devil rushed out of the room, daring my grandpa to chase him. Grandpa didn't hesitate. He mounted the horse he had tied up outside and tore off through the woods and brush. No matter how fast he rode, he couldn't catch up. Next morning, woke up in his bed, convinced it was all a dream. But when he went outside to check on his horse, the animal bore scratches from the branches and brambles. Tracing the horse's hoof prints, Grandpa discovered a separate set of tracks in the woods, made by a chicken foot and a goat hoof. As a nosy little kid who wanted to grow up and be a writer, I spent much of my childhood visiting a little greenhouse on San Antonio's west side, collecting stories from my grandpa, Carlos Peña. His legend had already reached mythic proportions by the time I came along in 1996. In fact, it had become a family tradition to traumatize little kids with the story of the night he met the devil. Grandpa Carlos had bright white hair and a matching mustache, was a quintessential Mexican cowboy who, at 6 feet tall, towered over me. I called him Grampito, a portmanteau of Grandpa and Abuelito. It came easily in a house full of Spanglish. He was almost never without a baseball cap or a cowboy hat, and in his later years, once my grandma wasn't around to police his fashion, he was the king of camouflage, often dressing up in a full camo outfit with clashing patterns. Under a pecan tree in his front yard or at the foot of the green recliner in the living room, I listened to tales from his life as a zookeeper, a lion tamer, and a migrant farmer. For the most part, the stories were true. For example, he loved to relate how my grandma, Josefina, was tricked into marrying him. They met at a dance in Anahuac in the early 20s when she stole him away from another woman, thinking he was rich because he was from out of town and dressed in nice clothes. After they got married, she found herself in a one-room house on his family's small ranch, which they called La Escuadra, shooting rabbits and cooking them for dinner. Neither of them came from much. Grandma was raised by a single mother in Lampazos de Narano, Nuevo León, who cleaned and cooked for her neighbors to provide for her three children. Grandpa had to drop out of elementary school in Camarón to help support his family. For a while, he rode his horse door-to-door around the neighborhood, selling his mother's homemade cheese for 10 cents a tin. He also helped tend to his family's chickens, goats, and horses. He felt a kinship with animals, as they did with him. Years later, at his house in San Antonio, stray cats, dogs, and even a forlorn pig showed up at his doorstep. Grandparents were happily occupied, a shack in the little corner of La Escuadra, where Grandpa's mother and brother also lived in a second shack. With the births of the first two children, Rebecca and Carlos, it became clear they had outgrown it. Looking for more money and better job prospects, Grandpa has eyes on Texas. He came to the United States on the afternoon of May 4, 1954, when he was 25, leaving his wife behind in Mexico until he could find work. After taking a train to Laredo, he made his way by bus to San Antonio, where his sister Lilia was living. He landed a series of restaurant construction jobs, saving as much money as he could. A year later, my grandma and their two young children followed him to Texas. As their family grew, they traveled together to Germantown, Tennessee, a Memphis suburb where Grandpa trained polo ponies. Then they spent summers driving through several Midwestern states where they worked as seasonal migrant farmers, picking cherries, strawberries, and tomatoes. My mom, Raquel, was the last of their eight children and missed out on all the hard labor. In the early 60s, Grandpa took a job at the San Antonio Zoo, feeding the animals and cleaning their enclosures. Among hippos, elephants, and tigers, he was profoundly at ease. He'd put on impromptu shows for visitors, even sticking his head between a hippo's jaws right before it clamped down on its food. Not long after Grandpa started working there, a two-day-old lion cub was donated to the zoo, and the zoo needed someone to take him home until he was old enough to live in captivity on his own. Grandpa's reputation as an animal whisperer had grown, and zoo officials asked if he'd be interested. He said yes. He named the cub Simba, Swahili for lion, long before anyone associated the name with the Lion King. Simba slept in my grandparents' bedroom in a milk crate, and every day he'd plop down in the passenger seat of Grandpa's pickup truck, sticking his head out the window like a dog. When the pair returned home in the evenings, the kid would invite their friends over to play with the cub. As the cub grew older and had to live full-time at the zoo, Grandpa was the only person Simba trusted to enter his den. When the two of them were there and others entered, the lion would often rear up on his hind legs as if to protect Grandpa from intruders. Even as Simba began sprouting a mane and put on a few hundred pounds, he would still play as he did when he was a cub, nibbling on Grandpa's arms without biting down. Unfortunately, their time together was cut short. After an unpleasant incident with the world-renowned Italian elephant trainer, my Grandpa was fired from the zoo. But that's a story for another time. Little sidebar here. This is Meanwhile in Texas. Squirrel terrorized a Cypress neighborhood, inflicting bite wounds that sent two people to the hospital. The Mars Wrigley Confectionery Plant in Waco unveiled the world's largest Snickers bar, which is 12 foot long and weighs 4,728 pounds. A Flint woman and her daughter were charged with stalking after they allegedly used witchcraft and demonic items to scare an ex-girlfriend of the woman's husband. Hundreds of vultures made their homes on a U.S. Customs and Border Protection radio tower in Kingsville, much to the chagrin of border officials who have to deal with the birds' frequent vomiting and defecation. The co-owner of a pet food distributor in Minster pledged to eat nothing but dog food for 30 days. After he was fired from a Dallas restaurant, a man allegedly picked up a sword staff used to cut open champagne bottles and began to swing it around. An administrator at Arlington's Oak Ridge School donated a kidney to the father of three of her students. A San Antonio couple named their baby after an HEB cashier who helped them feel less stressed about the pregnancy by joking that the mother appeared to be hiding a watermelon under her shirt. An Austin woman gave birth to a baby girl during her older child's academic awards ceremony. Family that claimed their daughter's Elsa doll might be haunted because it kept showing up in their house after they threw it away, mailed it to a friend in Minnesota who then taped it to his Jeep's brush guard. And all that was put together by Leif Reichstad. We return now to our original text here. Though I relished hearing the stories of Grandpa's lion taming antics, I didn't get to witness them. By the time I was born, he had retired. I spent most of my days with my grandparents, my sister, and my cousins at the little green house. When I attended Las Palmas Elementary on the west side, my grandparents would get there early in the afternoon to pick me up, ensuring no one beat them to the prime parking spot under the shade of a tree. Then came Sundays. I never questioned the tradition. I just grew up knowing there was no sense in making plans that day. Our extended family would make its weekly pilgrimage to the little green house, and there I'd hear everyone else's stories about him, too. I learned about the time my grandpa's truck flipped over while he was driving alone. At 68 years old, with two broken collarbones, he kicked out the windshield to escape from the vehicle. I heard about the time back in Mexico when he used the branches to kill two angry rattlesnakes that were blocking his path. He later had them skinned, made into a belt, which would break out on birthdays or Easter Sunday. Grandpa taught us to be fearless. No one in my family became Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts because we didn't need to. Grandpa taught us to work with animals and enjoy the outdoors. At his six-acre ranch in Somerset, a few miles southwest of San Antonio, we got crash courses in knot tying and horseback riding and collecting pecans, chiles, and mesquite pods. Throughout elementary school, I bragged my classmates about pet goats, peacocks, and our prized emu. That's another story. Once on the way to his ranch, Grandpa spotted the 5-foot-tall bird which had escaped from a nearby property and was darting around the dirt access road. He grabbed the rope he always kept on hand, and the emu was quickly secured in the back of his truck and on its way to a corral on his property. When I was in middle school, my family moved a few miles north of San Antonio, which was too far for my grandparents to pick me up every afternoon, but I still spent Sundays and summers back at their house with my sister. Though my grandma wasn't as obvious about playing favorites among the grandchildren, Grandpa always let me and my sister know we were special. No matter how old we got, the bottom drawer of the fridge was always stocked with cans of Jumex, and a plastic bag full of cans of Pringles was always slung around the back of the kitchen chair, both waiting there exclusively for us. Even if the house was crowded, we were the only ones to whom he would offer tortillas con mantequilla. A few years ago, we lost my grandma. Though she stood barely 5 feet tall, she was the rock of our family, and her absence changed my grandpa. Unlike his wife, who was a devout Catholic, Grandpa was a staunch agnostic who frequently criticized religion, especially TV preachers. But after her death, he began to speak hopefully about the afterlife. If there is a heaven, at least I'll get to see my tapita again, he would say. To our surprise, he stepped into the roles she'd always filled, making us breakfast, cooking us tortillas. Before long, our Sunday visits to what we had always thought of as Grandma's house became visits to Grandpa's house. Early last year, my mom called to tell me that Grandpa, who was 89 years old, was seriously ill. Life without him wasn't something that I'd ever prepared for. And even after that first call, I denied that it was a possibility. If there was anyone who could beat whatever silent war was raging in his lungs, it was the same man who had chased after the devil, the same man who'd quit smoking cold turkey years earlier. Grandpa's cigarettes were a fixture of my early memories. Entering his room had meant stepping into a haze of smoke that surrounded him in his favorite chair as he watched his novellas. Feeling a bit overzealous after graduating from my elementary school's D.A.R.E. program, I'd set out on a campaign to get him to quit. While I sometimes sneaked packs of cigarettes out of his front pocket, it was guilt that seemed to work the best. I'd beg him to give them up, incentivizing him with memories I hadn't made yet. My high school graduation, or my sister's first day of kindergarten. He'd playfully argue with me, letting me know he was an old man who would leave us one day soon, whether he smoked or not. He was always better prepared for that day than I was. Grandpa was eventually diagnosed with COPD, a chronic pulmonary disease that worsens with time and makes it difficult to breathe, and he was presumed to have lung cancer. The doctors said they couldn't say for sure because he had declined a biopsy. I'd been living in Austin for 4.5 years when he was diagnosed. Throughout college, I'd come back to San Antonio once or twice a month, sometimes grudgingly giving up new experiences and time with new friends. But after Grandpa got his diagnosis, the time that passed between those 90-minute drives felt like an eternity. First time I came home after he fell ill, he was in the same chair as always, but this time sitting beside an oxygen tank and a nebulizer, neither of which he had relied on yet. Before the next visit, I was warned that he might look a little different, and I came home to find him looking more gaunt, joking and laughing as usual between bouts of coughing. Then, one day, I was returning to Austin from a hike at a nearby park when I got a text from my dad that Grandpa was in the hospital. I drove to San Antonio in a daze, propelled forward only by my fear and by my frustration. I couldn't control what was happening to him. After that, I might never hear his voice again. I opened my phone's recording app as my sister and I entered his room in hopes that I would capture the greeting he always welcomed with. Like clockwork, he says, "¿Dónde están mis bebitas de mundo?" Where are my baby girls, my whole world? He never got to go home again. He started sleeping more and eating less, and as he declined, our extended clan became the family, the hospital staff's nightmares, various aunts and uncles taking shifts, so Grandpa was never alone. One day, 68 people stopped by to see him. The nursing staff placed a smiling sun sticker above the door frame. Later learned that this was a hospital code that let the nurses know to be on their A game because there were a lot of eyes on them. In late April, we moved Grandpa to a hospice center. We overran the place, filling the halls with the aroma of jalapenos for fresh salsa and a whole cooler's worth of brisket. We leaned on one another for comfort. During the last month of his life, it was devastating to see our superhero, larger-than-life legend we had spent our lives idolizing, lying in a hospital bed. My grandpa's funeral was on May 1st, 2019, his 90th birthday. In the months before his death, he told his friends and family to save the date, joking, "It might be my birthday, might be my funeral, but either way, you're invited." For the last 7 years of his life, up until his hospitalization, Grandpa would go to the San Fernando Cemetery almost every day to neaten up the area around his wife's grave, and then the grave of his daughter Blanca, whom he buried when she was 46. The drive to take him there to join my grandma and my aunt was especially painful. The funeral procession made its way past his house, where his pickup truck was parked in the driveway, through his west side neighborhood, and then past the elementary school, where he and my grandma had picked me up after school nearly every day, until we finally arrived at the cemetery. The roads at the cemetery are narrow and uneven, and on the afternoon of May 1st, it was difficult to get by the dozens of cars belonging to everyone who'd come to lay my grandfather to rest. Someone later told me they hadn't seen a funeral procession so large since attending the service of an Air Force general. A group of mariachis gathered at the base of Grandpa's grave, singing Las Mañanitas, a song traditionally sung at birthdays. My family had spent the previous night regaling visitors with stories about him. Now, as each of us approached his lowered casket, we did so silently, tossing in a handful of dirt and a final goodbye. Ask any Mexican, and they'll probably have stories to tell about the time their family member or friend met the devil, or La Llorona, or some other demonic ghost. I've often joked that our culture is morbid, but the truth is, we tell these stories in order to survive. My grandfather came from dirt roads in Mexico. Together with my grandma, he built a life that was truly remarkable. Every story they told us, no matter how fanciful, had its roots on the other side of the border. Each story told us something about their place in the world as first-generation Mexican-Americans. Grandpa was unflinching in the face of the devil and could tame wild animals. And of course, he wasn't afraid to start over in a country where he didn't speak the language. And of course, he could laugh in the face of his own impending death. Everyone in my family is a descendant of those same dirt roads. We'll each eventually face our own demons and tame our own lions. We'll know it's possible because someone did it before us, the same stubborn fena fight that runs through our veins. Our accomplishments and failures are a continuation of the story that my grandparents began. And though some of the details might fade with memory, the stories will remain. They're the ones I'll tell my friends and share with my younger cousins when they get a little older. And one day, maybe on my front porch or under a pecan tree of my own, I'll tell my children the story of Carlos Peña, the man who played poker with the devil and lived to tell the tale. Turning now back to one of our feature articles. This is one we started last time, and we'll see if we can't finish it up today. This is about a very sad event back in Austin. The introduction: in 1978, an eighth grader from a prominent Austin family killed his teacher. More than four decades later, his classmates are still haunted by what happened that terrible day and after. The name of this story is The Aftermath. It's by Robert Draper. And I'll read the last couple of paragraphs from where we started off finished off last week. If I'd just done more for John earlier and been around more, George Christian said quietly. Garcia's story ran in the Statesman anyway. What remained unreported until now was the identity of the man who had become John's adopted father. He was a Dallas eye doctor named John Eisenlohr, who was a prominent member and later the president of the Texas Ophthalmological Association, a group whose lobbyist was George Christian. Eisenlohr's children attended Highland Park High School in the affluent community where John would spend the next 2.5 years. He enrolled at Highland Park High in the middle of his sophomore year. Rumors swirled around the quiet new student. One of his new classmates came across a newspaper story that identified John by name and described him as schizophrenic. The classmate wondered, why is he at our school? Those concerns subsided over time. John returned to his passion, drama, and also became the news editor of the school paper, The Bagpipe. A Dallas friend of George's wrote him to say that her daughter worked on the staff of The Bagpipe and has mentioned how much she admires the work John did and how intelligent he is. The Dallas media left John alone, so did the Austin press. John graduated from high school on schedule in May of 1982. That summer, he returned to the city of his youth and enrolled at the University of Texas at Austin. Now we're picking up what we haven't read before. A few weeks after the shooting, John's classmates graduated from Murchison Middle School in Austin. The following school year, they were bused to different high schools. They had spent the previous 2 years together, and their abrupt separation constituted a kind of loss unto itself. Who could possibly relate to their experience? He didn't know what to do with all these emotions, John Ray recalled. The message was, move on, move on. So the Murchison kids tried to move on. But Ray was as if the next few years were completely erased. Murchison friends were gone. His parents divorced. At 16, he began to drink heavily. His driver's license was suspended after he racked up speeding tickets. Austin felt strangely unsafe to him, even aside from willful recklessness. He toggled between hedonism and religion, each in zealous doses. Ray was among several Murchison alumni who went on to UT. There they began to see John Christian on campus, starring. Without ever consciously coming to this conclusion, most of the Murchison kids presumed that they had suffered two losses on May 18, 1978, their beloved teacher and their promising classmate. Few, if any, had considered the possibility that John might reappear in their midst, and they learned of his re-entry into their world, not through any notice from authorities, but instead through word of mouth and random encounters. One former classmate, Kathy Olson Muth, was home from college, eating with her family and friends at a restaurant in Northwest Hills. She happened to see a familiar reflection in a mirror. John Christian is sitting right behind me, she whispered to her mother. Wow, she thought, back in the neighborhood. Nothing is ever going to happen to that guy. Another Murchison student, David Miter, who ran into John at the Texas Tavern in the UT Student Union and learned that the boy who had killed one of Miter's favorite teachers was now studying at UT. How am I supposed to process that? Miter wondered. John went on to study at the university's prestigious law school. State Bar of Texas requires law students to disclose only current character issues and mental illnesses, not past ones. In 1990, Susie Jerry Davis was living in Fort Worth and reading a book at home while her two young children napped when she inexplicably started to cry. Then the images resurfaced out of nowhere. A boy with a gun, teacher on the floor, blood gushing, the noises, the gunshots, the screams, the scraping of chairs. Then, as Davis would write in her 2015 book, Unafraid, I could smell everything. Gunpowder, pencils, chalk dust, the perfume I sprayed on my t-shirt that day. Later, she began sharing her trauma with a small group of Christian women. Bit by bit, she recalled panic attacks she experienced in high school, moments of jogging past John's house in Northwest Hills and being afraid that he might see her. As Davis recalled in Unafraid, until fully accepting God's love and the injunction of forgiveness that came with it, I figured John had wrecked my life at 14, walked in with that rifle and blew away my childhood, my sense of safety, and my hope for a happily ever after. 1993, soon after she and her family returned to Austin, Davis was shopping for breakfast cereal at a grocery store in Northwest Hills with her four-year-old daughter when she heard someone say, "Hi, Susie, how are you doing?" Was John hugging her daughter close and wanting to scream. Davis carried on a banal conversation about his job and her church. It was only after she got her daughter into the car that she began to sob, and she prayed to God for grace toward John. Slowly, she could feel compassion seep in. At a charity gala in downtown Austin in 1992, Peyton Smith, by then a 28-year-old attorney, looked across the dance floor to see a smiling and tuxedoed John coming his way. John hugged him. "It's so good to see you," exclaimed the classmate Smith had last seen with a hunting rifle in his hands. John attempted to make small talk, but Smith abruptly cut him off and told him that he owed a visit to someone else. Walking away, Smith felt a sense of disgust. Unlike his old friend Davis, who had been swallowed up by fear and then moved by her faith toward forgiveness, the boy who had been closest to the line of fire that morning had since carried himself with a sense of imperviousness. He had yet to make peace with the incident. As he would write on the Facebook group that Ray dedicated to Grayson, that moment is still as raw and real and technicolor today as 40 years ago. And we're at a pretty good break spot here to right in the middle of the show almost. Remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or you can listen at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and the Sound Broadcasting, 1967. Back to our story, The Aftermath. Ray, in the meantime, had continued to spend his post-Murchison years in a state of what he would tactfully term self-anesthetizing. A wayward path took him to Central America, where he was inspired to later attend seminary and become a spiritual director, essentially a roving, ordained minister gravitating to those who had experienced trauma. But Ray had not so much as acknowledged his own emotional scar tissue until one morning in April 1999, when he was driving through the University of Arkansas campus and heard on the radio about the mass shooting at Columbine High School. Suddenly, he thought he saw a jumbo jet nosediving into Razorback Stadium. He pulled over to the side of the road, awaiting a fiery explosion, but it never came. The hallucination portended something. Something in his psyche began to crack open. A few days later, Ray drove 12 hours northwest to Littleton, Colorado. Rolling past the high school, wandering through the memorial sites and services, Ray felt curiously at home with the grieving, as if his own trauma had been given permission to voice itself. It all felt surreal, Ray said. 20 years overdue. I don't remember talking to anyone specifically. I think it was all I could do just to be there. Ray called his old classmate, Susie Jerry Davis, who happened to be in Colorado on vacation. They met up for the first time in years to talk about the grief they'd carried for 2 decades. Davis later called their former teacher, Marilyn Eichenbaum Duvon, who then reconnected with other former students who were in Grayson's classroom that day. They were among the many Murchison alumni who would later recall the Columbine tragedy as a moment when they felt engulfed by their own past and became, in effect, witnesses again to the loss of their innocence. 10 years later, in 2009, Ray's youngest daughter, Olivia, who was 10 years old, was struck by a Cadillac Escalade and killed at a street crossing on Razorback Road while her sister, Hannah, watched. The driver of the Escalade was a well-to-do lawyer's son who hailed from Highland Park and was attending the University of Arkansas. Ray's pro bono lawyer was outmatched by the legal team assembled by the young driver's father. Faced with a protracted battle and not wanting to see a young person suffer for something he hadn't intended to do, Ray and his wife ultimately chose not to pursue civil litigation. His daughter's death did not make Ray angry at God, but he found plenty of fault with God's creatures. He couldn't fathom how the world continued to carry on while an innocent girl lay buried and how quickly some young men were issued reprieves. Still, the fury was as oppressive as the grief. Then came the deep work. The, okay, what do I do with this? How do I deal with it, he recalled. Reading, praying, counseling. It peeled back all the layers. Beneath all the destructive behavior and armoring up emotionally, there was that one event. Ray recounted all this while sitting on the patio of a South Austin coffee house one morning this past September. He had a notebook in front of him that he had been filling with random musings. The notes were the beginning of a book manuscript that a literary agent was urging him to write. Its tentative title is A Field Guide to Grief. My first face-to-face meeting with Ray, but our initial conversation had been 20 years earlier, just after the Columbine High School massacre. He was trying to get in touch with a former classmate, Rob Draper, who he'd heard had just published a novel. Ray looked me up, and yes, I had just published my first novel, but no, I wasn't the Rob Draper who had gone to Murchison. Still, Ray kept talking. Within minutes, I was learning for the first time about the shooting on May 18, 1978. Like most Austin journalists, I knew George Christian as a towering, back-slapping eminence. It struck me as odd that I'd never heard about his sons having killed a school teacher, particularly since I'd been a staff writer at Texas Monthly for most of the 90s. After speaking to Ray in 1999, I wrote John Christian a letter to see if he would be willing to share his story in GQ, where I was working at the time. A few days later, my phone rang. It was George. John won't talk to you. None of us will talk to you, he said. And if you publish this story, it will destroy our family. My editor at GQ ultimately decided the story would not work without the shooter's participation. In the ensuing years, I gave little thought to the Austin tragedy. George died of lung cancer in 2002. Joanne died in 2015. Then on May 18th, 2018, I received an email from a Washington, D.C.-based journalist named David Nather, whom I had never met. The subject line was, "Question for you, Murchison shooting." Nather, as it turned out, had attended Murchison in 1978 and had been outside during gym class when John emerged from the school entrance with a rifle in his hand. He had heard from Ray that I had looked into the story and was curious why I had dropped it. The shooting was on Nather's mind, he wrote in an email, because that day marked its 40th anniversary, a fact that he might have forgotten but for the reminder he received courtesy of the morning's horrific body count at Santa Fe High School. Even for those of us who weren't in the classroom, there's a chilling kind of flashback that happens with every school shooting, he wrote me. Like others who had experienced the Murchison shooting, Nather remained perplexed by the aftermath. The swiftness of the court proceedings, the secrecy that attended John's road to recovery, and the seeming normalcy of his adult life. Everything was a gnawing mystery. In Nather's view, the recognition that so many lives were deeply affected by the shooting was proof that such a story needed to be written. What had kept him from writing it himself was that he hated the thought of bringing anguish to his former classmate, John Christian. I heard that sentiment expressed by nearly all his Murchison classmates. They do not bear John any ill will. Still, none of them understand what drove him to kill the teacher he seemed to love as much as they did. Given that no one had ever explained anything about John's treatment and release from custody, some worried that he might still be capable of committing a violent act. Even those who believed him to be harmless couldn't help but be bothered by the soft landing he seemed to have been accorded. Family's position, which has remained unchanged over the years, is that a 13-year-old boy fell into a deep, perhaps psychotic state of depression and committed a terrible misdeed. As a juvenile, he was entitled to anonymity, but because his father was a public figure, the boy's identity was splashed across the front pages. He received intensive psychiatric treatment, was deemed by professionals to pose no threat of further violence, and was released to live a quiet and productive life. He had done all the system had asked of him. No more need be asked, or should be asked, especially after the passage of so many years. Of course, juveniles are often named by the media in cases involving murder, and though sentencing laws vary widely across the country and have evolved over time, the system has historically tended to ask a great deal more of juvenile killers. In 1984, the system asked 12 years in prison of a 15-year-old Colorado boy named Jason Rocha, who suffered from depression but had committed no prior acts of violence before he shot his 13-year-old friend to death. 1988, the system assigned 206 years in prison to a Montana boy named Christopher Hans, who, as a 14-year-old, had murdered a teacher and wounded three others after he received a failing grade. 1992, Texas sentenced Edwin Dubrow to 27 years for killing a cab driver during an attempted robbery, despite the fact that the 12-year-old was too young to stand trial as an adult. Texas Monthly's Skip Hollinsworth wrote about Dubrow. While touring several Texas Youth Commission facilities for a Texas Monthly story about juvenile justice I wrote in 1996, I happened to meet a number of juvenile killers. They all came from low-income backgrounds and were, with few exceptions, children of color. Yet for the witnesses of the Murchison shooting, their longing for justice has little to do with the length of John's sentence, and indeed, many would agree that more juvenile offenders should be treated as John was, rather than the other way around. As University of Texas professor Marilyn Armour, founder of the Institute of Restorative Justice and Restorative Dialogue, told me, there are some people who believe that the amount of time served, severity of the punishment, bring some measure of closure or satisfaction. According to the research I've done, that's not what happens at all. Armour is among the criminal justice reformers who have pressed for opportunities in which all stakeholders in a tragic event can come together and articulate their discontents and needs in the interest of restorative justice. Such occasions have famously occurred in resolving inter-ethnic calamities in South Africa and Rwanda, and throughout the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. On a smaller scale, restorative dialogues have been used in disputes between the local police and their respective communities, including in Austin. In any such scenario, however, the process can only succeed if both sides participate. Getting answers is what brings resolution, Armour says. And beyond getting information, there's equally the need to express what role this particular event has played in their lives. Today, because of the absence of information, those who watched John shoot their teacher are still left wondering about a fundamental question: has he ever expressed any remorse? Some of them have searched for answers themselves. A few years before the 40th anniversary, Ray was visiting Austin and jogging around Lady Bird Lake when he thought he saw John. He looked him up in the phone book and left John a voicemail. "Hey, I know this is weird, but I would really like to get together and talk." He never heard back. One person close to John told me that he has felt great sadness over the years for what he did. John's older brother, George Scott, described him as a really fine family person, gentle. He's been a great uncle to my kids. He's a really great brother. I have nothing but good things to say about him in the settings I see him in. While George Scott fully acknowledged the magnitude of the tragedy for the victims of that day's events, he also explained that in his view, his brother has, quote, done remarkably well given the terrible thing that happened. He's definitely made the most of the opportunity that he's got. But George Scott went on to say that he, like the witnesses to the shooting, has been haunted by the incident. I've never spoke with him about it. I've talked about it with my wife quite a bit. Should I do that? I'm just a scaredy cat. I've been very hesitant to open the issue, and I probably should have, and I may yet do it. Talk to my therapist about this. I've been advised it might help me to come to terms with it as well. I've had a conversation with other people in the family, but not him. It's crazy. We've thought, what happened? What happened? You know, there's been that conversation. We have not done a good job bringing it up directly. I'm not proud of that. As Ray explained it, the tragedy is that Mr. Grayson was killed. The collateral, continuing tragedy is this silence around the event. He added, I know a couple people who've said, we don't know where this Texas Monthly story is going. They don't want it to be a hit piece on a Christian family or something that says this kid escapes justice. I don't want to hurt John. At the same time, I don't think the opposite of that is to deny what happened to us. I think we can tell the story. We can own the pain. We can call this what it was without being in the spirit of hurting the person who did it. You ask how I got through. Maybe better to ask how I'm getting through. I will never be over seeing Mr. Grayson murdered by a friend and classmate. I will never get over losing Olivia. I've gotten through in the past by ignoring the events, denying their reality and power. I'm getting through now by trying to be more honest, trying to show up, pay attention, and stay in the game. I seek to put myself, as much as I am able, in the proximity of others suffering. As a pastor, I try and lead our church to embrace the refugee, disabled, those on the margins, those turned away from other churches. I try and pay attention to my own pain, but not expect more from myself than I can give, knowing I will be a fraud if I do. I know these words may make me sound noble or wise, but understand, if I knew another way that was easier, one that I didn't see ending me up as an utter shipwreck, I'd take it in a heartbeat. In the end, this is the only path I see that makes sense. That has any hope, however long the shot. Get no satisfaction from feeling like I've found some secret. I'm incredibly grateful for the sense of being found and rescued in spite of myself, in spite of what could have been, in spite of all that is. That's from a letter from John Ray. Laura Grayson, the widow of the murdered teacher, has been back to the cemetery only once since Rod's funeral. Their son, Ian, was an eighth grader by then, coincidentally the same age as Rod's student when he was killed, and she wanted him to know where his dad's gravesite was in case he ever wanted to visit. Rod had once told Laura that when he died, he would like to be ferried in a boat downriver in the manner of a Viking funeral, or maybe sent off into space. Then again, he also said of being buried, it's not where I am. She knew that. She saw him instead in dreams. When she lit candles, she remembered how he once laughed at her Catholic rituals and then said, we're doing a pact. Whoever dies first has to come back and tell the other if the candles mean anything. After Rod died, she went to see a psychic who informed her, "He's standing behind you. He's got his hands on your shoulders, and he's kissing your head. And he wants you to know that every candle you light helps to light the way." But where she really saw her husband was in the classroom. Laura had been a teacher before Rod became one, and she continued that work long after he died. Where he had mesmerized Murchison, gifted and talented, Laura taught mostly those who were socially disadvantaged or at risk. Better to continue applying her passions in this manner, she had decided after his death, than to bask in bitterness. Easier said than done, of course. Back in the early 90s, Laura happened to meet a woman who had worked as an intake officer at the Gardner Betts juvenile facility where John had spent 2 weeks immediately after killing her husband. She recalled that on the same day that John was arrested, two Latino boys were brought in for shoplifting. Those boys were subsequently sentenced to a juvenile institution for their crime. A sense of injustice overwhelmed Laura. "If I allowed anger to control me, what kind of life would I have made for Ian?" she said. "I remember making that conscious decision." She sued the Christians for negligence a year after Rod's death. 2 years later, in 1981, the two sides settled for an undisclosed sum that included a trust fund whose proceeds Ian would receive on his 18th and 21st birthdays. In 1995, after the first installment of that money arrived, Laura and Ian sought to fund a bench that would be dedicated to Rod, situated on a trail he loved on Lady Bird Lake. She was told by city authorities that no space was available. Laura couldn't help but wonder if she would have gotten a different answer had her last name been Christian. Recently, a fellow school teacher told Laura that he had traveled to Emporia State University in Kansas over spring break to visit the National Teachers Hall of Fame. A new site had been erected called the Memorial to Fallen Educators, which was designated as a national memorial in 2018. The names engraved on two granite slabs included teachers from Sandy Hook, Marjorie Stoneman, Douglas, Santa Fe, and, yes, Wilbur, Rod Grayson, Murchison Junior High. Now that she's retired, Laura is hoping to travel to Emporia to see her husband's name among the others. A roll call of more than 120 heroes, a list that grows every year. The author of this piece, Robert Draper, is a contributing editor at Texas Monthly, contributing writer at National Geographic and the New York Times Magazine, and the author of the upcoming book, To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. Turn now to some of the restaurant reviews for this month. There's a couple new places and some redos here in Houston. We'll get there first. First up is Bamboo House, a new Chinese place. 2 stars and $2 signs. This packed Westheimer outpost of the original in Humboldt attracts a largely Asian crowd. A good sign. We pre-ordered a half Peking duck, still waited for a table given the restaurant's no reservations policy. Not a problem. When we were seated, the glossy mound of tender meat arrived along with plum sauce, greens, and pancakes wrapping around the meat and skin. It was lovely. Next time, though, we would skip the accompanying thin soup, which contained more bone than meat. We were covered with drunken pork dumplings, tender and juicy in a standout sizzling beef dish. A huge portion of meat marinated in vinegar and sugar and flamed dramatically tableside with whiskey, to the delight of our table neighbors and their kids. Beef sprouts cooked with minced garlic and a platter of fluffy chicken fried rice with hefty chunks of meat rounded out our meal and us nicely. Bring your own bottle. 5901 Westheimer Road. We're open for lunch and dinner 7 days, but if you call them at 281-888-3385, maybe we can find out if they do delivery or takeout. Let's see, got any more new places here in Houston. Momo House, a new Nepalese place, 2 stars with a single dollar sign. It's a quiet place tucked into a strikingly diverse strip east of the Mahatma District. A good place to broaden one's sense of Nepalese cuisine. Dining room with its shades of blue paint and hanging prayer flags makes a peaceful setting, while the food runs counterpoint with hot, complex dishes in which spices predominate. We started with Biro Alu, potatoes fried in butter with garlic, fenugreek, turmeric, cumin, and green chilies. The namesake momos came next, delicately pinched dumplings that we swished through spicy sauces, as well as chicken wings dripping with Himalayan herbs. Finally, the thali arrived, loaded with bowls of pounded rice, lentils, vegetables, yogurt, and meat. Also a BYOB place at 6121 Hillcroft, lunch and dinner Tuesday through Sunday, but these days, call 713-505-1300. See if they're doing delivery or takeout. Next up is another new place, Jabu 2. It's a two-star new Japanese place with $2 signs. If you're not familiar, you might want to watch a YouTube video on how to eat shabu shabu, also known as Japanese hot pot, before visiting this newcomer, pronounced Shabu Squared. However, the friendly staff at the bright modern eatery with big booths and a large central bar will guide you through every step. Onomatopoeia for swish swish. Shabu shabu is tabletop cooking featuring raw, thinly sliced meat or seafood and vegetables quickly boiled in a large pot of broth. Anticipate a few appetizers such as truffled edamame and spicy Persian cucumbers. A cool, crisp way to start, but hot pot is the bulk of the menu. Of the five broths, we chose the tonkatsu, to which we added vegetables, a wide array from bok choy to watercress, and switched in tender beef ribeye, which cooked in seconds. Then we dipped the meat into two tasty sauces, which can be doctored with fresh garlic, scallions, and so on, and ate it over rice. It's fun, interactive dining, and healthy to boot. We serve beer and sake at 5840 West Sam Houston Parkway South. Call ahead 346-342-1866. Open for lunch and dinner 7 days. We also got a new Mediterranean place called Torchy. It's 2 stars with a single dollar sign. Let's see. It's Egyptian-born Rafik Abu Hatab comes to Houston's Palatine Row Food Hall with a Mediterranean concept similar to his original New Orleans St. Roch Market. Dips and classic meze served with pita are good for sharing. We preferred the beautifully presented fadme with mint and za'atar spice over the hummus and grape leaves. Entrees come with your pick of 3 sides. Chicken shawarma was nicely spiced, but the hummus was ho-hum and rice salty and undercooked. There's a handy central bar in the family-friendly food hall dispensing cocktails, wine, and beer. There is a bar. It's at 2445 Times Boulevard near Rice Village, 713-489-2546 for lunch and dinner 7 days. We got another one here. Let's see. This is an update here of Elliot's Table, 3-star, $3 sign, American food. Chef Elliot Roddy's small, bustling Heights restaurant, both energizing and comforting, and the food is eclectic, satisfying American with a southern bent. Roasted oysters with salt pork, parmesan, and herb butter near greatness with their splash of charred citrus. The addition of smoked pork made an ordinary mac and cheese a delight. What could have been a ho-hum roasted beet salad was perfection here, with arugula, prosciutto, goat cheese, and balsamic pecans. Creole seasoning on a vermilion snapper had just enough bite to flavor but not overwhelm the fish, and a generous baseball-cut New York strip. Served with some of the best home-style fries we've crunched through, arrived cooked a just-right medium rare. Only a heavy key lime cake disappointed. Beer and wine at 465 D.C. Jester Boulevard. Dinner Wednesday through Saturday and brunch on Sundays. Call ahead these days, 713-485-0340. Another update here is La Vibra Tacos, a 2-star, $2 sign, up-to-date Mexican food. La Vibra's good vibes are evident in the open room, servers' smiling faces, and the authentic Mexico City-style tacos. Our lunch began with house-made corn tortillas that could have been served alone, merely dipped into any of the 6 luscious salsas. From the Clásico tacos, we greedily wolfed down a wonderful pastor with pineapple, onion, and cilantro, a spicy guajillas with melted Oaxacan cheese, and finally a lightly battered camarón with chipotle slaw. equal billing goes to the unusual and delightful costras, tortillas of griddled Gouda cheese wrapped around fillings and rolled up in flour tortillas. Though a dry pollo volcán paled a bit in comparison, our crispy, crumbling chicharrón de queso had us picking its delectable fallen shards from our plates. Served beer and wine, 506 Yale, lunch and dinner, 7 days. Calling ahead's the right thing to do these days. 713-389-5783. And let's see, another update. It's a French place, Etoile, 3-star, $3 signs. This pretty place in Uptown is so very French, with both traditional and seasonal menus and outside tables. Inside are a couple of dining rooms. If you seek quiet, ask for the wine room. Almost every recent dish pleased our picky group, from the deep, rich onion soup in its broad bowl with a floating pancake-sized Gruyere crouton to a juicy heirloom tomato salad with creamy burrata cheese, black olives, Basil pesto. Main courses include tender veal sweetbreads with potato mousseline, Brussels sprouts, carrots, and a morel sauce, and filet au poivre, 8 ounces of beef drizzled cognac sauce, and served with a huge cone of crisp, hot, slender fries. Though the butternut squash mousseline sauce on a seared salmon seemed too sweet to us, we couldn't fault the sweetness of an apple tart with ice cream and caramel sauce. It was a bar. It's at 1101-11 Uptown Park Boulevard, lunch Monday through Friday, dinner 7 days a week, brunch Saturday and Sunday. Call ahead, though, 832-668-5808. And let's see, another update. This is an Indian restaurant, Veranda, Progressive Indian Cuisine, 3 stars and $3 signs. Quite enough to hear a pin drop. Sunil and Anupama Srivastava's spot in the polished multi-use curvy collection is ideal for guests who shun loud music and trendy crowds. Peaceful to dine in this space, with features high ceilings, textured tiles, flickering candles, and comfortable banquettes. Tandoor blistered naan, go for the rosemary and olive oil. It's a fine way to start, but good luck resisting the entire basket. Continuing the carb fest, we inhale lotus root dumplings, cloud-like pillows, and a spicy ginger tomato yogurt broth. Golden shrimp curry is a crowd pleaser. Medium spicy, super creamy, but not too rich. Sadly, its accompanying saffron rice lacked saffron flavor. The side of cucumber raita was thin and bland. Surprising highlight was the okra with fennel strips and tart mango powder. It's a bar. It's at 3300 Kirby Drive. Lunch and dinner 7 days. Call ahead, 281-501-0258. And our last update here is Nancy Tusk, 3-star, $2 signs, New American Cooking. Expect crowds, noise, expert servers, and fab food at this award-winning Edu mainstay. Burned out on Brussels? Try the roasted virgin here, splendid in a tomato sauce redolent with tuna and parmesan. The ricotta and nachi proved equally fine, lovely tender morsels with roasted mushroom, pecorino, and tarragon. Both entrees pleased as well. A wood-grilled half-chicken, tender and juicy, Basque chilies, charred scallions, and preserved lemon juice for extra kick. Smoky tasting pan roasted bass, tangy crust of brown butter, capers, and lemon. Though it might dull your appetite for the rest of the meal, an order of buckwheat sourdough bread and cultured butter with savory satsuma jam will make you very happy. There is a bar. It's 2704 Polk. Open for dinner Tuesday through Sunday. Call ahead, see if they're doing takeout or delivery. 346-571-7931. And while the world is closed to us, I apologize for tormenting you with restaurant reviews. But that way we'll know where we're going as soon as they let us go back out. And that brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoon at 5, Monday afternoon at 2. Psych.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by Audiobook News at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Medical Center Hospital ProCare primary care physicians and specialists are continuing to provide care during the COVID-19 pandemic through telehealth visits. This allows established and new patients to visit with a doctor from the comfort of their own homes. Patients can connect directly with a provider from their smartphone, computer, or tablet. Simply call one of our MCH ProCare offices to schedule an appointment. For a list of providers, they can also visit procareodessa.com/find-a-physician or call 640-6468 for more information. Medical Center Health System and MCH ProCare want the community to know we are here for the community during these uncertain times and that we are dedicated to continue making sure West Texans are treated and taken care of.
Starting Tuesday on the Noon Book Hour, Texas Outlaw by James Patterson. Texas Ranger Rory Yates is not keen for hero status, but it's unavoidable once his girlfriend, country singer Willow Dawes, writes a song about his bravery. Rory escapes his newfound fame when he's sent to the remote West Texas town of Rio Lobo, a municipality with two stoplights, and now, according to the chief of police, one too many Texas Rangers. Rio Lobo Detective Ariana Delgado is the one who requested Rory, and the only person who believes a local councilwoman's seemingly accidental death is a murder. Then Rory begins to uncover a tangle of small-town secrets as crooked as Texas law is straight. To get to the truth before more people die, Rory is forced to take liberties with the investigation. Texas Outlaw by James Patterson, starting Tuesday at noon and Wednesday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 98 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 70s. Then tomorrow, mostly sunny and hot with a high around 105. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg, While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark, revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From the Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas, with more than 7,000 azalea bushes, along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize Garden is transformed in another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare Hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden hosts other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA Garden Director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused, unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower-growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA's school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See, timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general, mid-March through early April, you should be able to enjoy the beauty of these gardens. If you come later, you may see many of the Satsuki varieties, which bloom in late April and into early June, depending on the variety, and the popular Encore series and other reblooming azaleas that produce a second wave of colorful blooms later in the year. The Disappeared Man Who Loved Azaleas by William Shike. The luxurious blooms of Hoying azalea hybrids hide a sad story about their corrector, T. Lin Hoying. This historically obscure man lived in China, where he bred numerous varieties of his beloved plant. During his homeland's Cultural Revolution between 1966 and 1976, Hoying was abruptly uprooted from his private azalea-strewn Shangri-La. Along with countless